The clerk will call the docket.
Mon Court, Judge Velasquez against the Commonwealth of Virginia. Dana R. Corbeer for the appellate, Mark R. Herring, Attorney General. Lauren C. Campbell, Assistant Attorney General for the appellate.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Dana R. Cormier, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Ramon Cortez Velasquez. There are two issues presented for appeal to the court, and I will begin with addressing the first issue, which is whether the timely filing of a notice of appeal in a criminal case deprives a trial court of the jurisdiction to consider a timely filed motion to withdraw a guilty plea. That specific issue sort of backs out into a more general issue, is whether and to what extent the filing of a notice of appeal divests the trial court of all jurisdiction. The Court of Appeals decision seems to indicate that once the notice of appeal is filed, that the trial court no longer has any jurisdiction over the case. But we know that there are several statutory and rule-based provisions that retain trial court jurisdiction in specific matters, specifically Rule 5:8, where the trial court may hold proceedings to determine the record on the appeal. We know under Virginia Code Section 8.01-248, trial court may correct the clerical errors in transcripts up and until the petition for appeal is filed in the appellate court. Once the and that's the Lamb case, which I've cited to, where Judge Crockton discusses these issues. And in Lamb, once the petition for appeal is filed in the appellate court, then the appellate court obtains jurisdiction and divests the trial court of jurisdiction.
Counsel, in your analysis, do you distinguish between, or should we distinguish between, appeals of right and discretionary appeals for purposes of the triggering event, the petition for appeal versus the motion?
I don't think so, because I think it makes sense, because I don't think the notice of appeal, and I think one of the courts, Gamesloy, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, talks about the notice of appeal being activating potential jurisdiction. We know that the filing of a notice of appeal by itself does not give the appellate court's jurisdiction, because it has to be timely filed, it has to contain the necessary parties, and there are other prerequisites that need to be in the notice of appeal before the court takes jurisdiction.
Right, but what I'm trying to unpack is, in an appeal of right, if the notice of appeal is statutorily and rule compliant, then it actually does vest appellate jurisdiction and power in the higher court. But not so in a discretionary appeal. You still have to petition the court, and the court has to agree to hear it. And until the court gets that petition or agrees to hear it, it's really not before the court. It's simply a request before the court. Now, that distinction may not work here, but I do see it in the case law, and I'm wondering if you're advocating for it or against it.
I would advocate that in appeal that the trial court has jurisdiction, even at the discretion where it's exercising the appellate court would obtain its jurisdiction when the petition for appeal requesting that the court take it is filed.
And I think that question,
but still, that gives plenty of
time. That question from Justice Kelsey, I discern as a very friendly question to you, because the Commonwealth relies on the Walton case against you, and the major difference with the Walton case is that that was a death penalty case.
Right.
And we don't have any choice but to review a death penalty case. So I would suggest that perhaps that question is actually one of the more friendly questions that you'll ever get.
Thank you. I appreciate that friendly question.
You're welcome.
Again, I think that the issue in discretionary appeal is, if you're returning, when does the trial court lose jurisdiction? And it ultimately in this discretionary appeal. And I think the cases that I've cited, particularly Lamb, Green, and Gamesloy, say this: when the petition for appeal is filed in the appellate court. Now, Commonwealth argues that distinguishes those cases by saying that once an appellate court assigns a record number to a case, that's when the appellate court obtains jurisdiction and divests the trial court of jurisdiction. I found no cases that say that is the distinguishing feature. Point out that the Commonwealth argues that the three Supreme Court cases deal with filing appeals in the Supreme Court, and when the petition for appeal is is filed in the Supreme Court, that is when the record number is assigned. But in the Court of Appeals, the record number is assigned on the notice of appeal. I don't think that distinction makes any difference because, again, as I stated before, full jurisdiction is not obtained until the petition for appeal is filed and all prerequisites are met. And I believe there's a case, Long v. Commonwealth, which is a Court of Appeals case, that also stands for the proposition that the petition for appeal is when the Court of Appeals acquires jurisdiction. So in this case, in the case of a discretionary appeal, I think the court has jurisdiction at the latest, the appellate court would obtain jurisdiction when the petition for appeal is filed, thus giving the trial court jurisdiction to consider a timely filed motion to withdraw guilty plea. And I would point out that there is nothing that would, if you read all the statutes, both this 19.2-296, which governs the motion to withdraw guilty plea, along with 19.2325, which is the deadline for filing a notice of appeal, there's nothing inconsistent with the deadlines in those two statutes. The 19.2-296 deadline is at 21 days from the entry of the written judgment. That is within the Rule 1.1 finality of judgment rule. It is also within the 19.2325 30-day deadline. And regarding the orderly administration of justice, which is what several cases discuss, the orderly administration of justice would, under both statutes, would allow a court to consider the motion to withdraw guilty plea within the 21-day time period. It would not affect the 30-day deadline whatsoever. So I think that the Court of Appeals and the trial court both erred by ruling that the trial court did not have jurisdiction to consider the motion to withdraw guilty plea, which was simultaneously and timely filed with the notice of appeal in this case.
Do you agree that the window closes when the 21 days have elapsed?
You mean if a motion to withdraw guilty plea is filed outside of the 21-day period?
No, the motion is timely filed, but for whatever reason, it's not ruled on within that 21 days.
I would agree there would have to be a ruling within 21 days, both legally under the statute and practically, in order to have a ruling, a timely ruling, in order to meet the appellate deadline.
What do we do with the rather difficult posture of the case where the trial judge said that he did not have jurisdiction to rule on the underlying motion to withdraw, but then he ruled on the underlying motion to withdraw after a hearing? So if we disagree with the trial judge and confirm that he did have jurisdiction, we'd also be disagreeing with the Court of Appeals, we have a decision on the merits at a time when he had jurisdiction. What do we do with it?
Well, I would say he ruled on that issue ultimately rule. He said, even though I don't have jurisdiction, if I did, I would deny it. So
that's
I would
right.
say I would say that if we meet the manifest injustice standard for the motion to withdraw guilty plea, that could be overruled, or it could be remanded to the Court of Appeals, which didn't consider the manifest injustice issue, because the Court of Appeals just said because there was no jurisdiction, it didn't reach the second issue. That may be one way to deal with that possibility, because the Court of Appeals didn't address manifest injustice.
All right.
With respect to the second issue, as to whether Mr. Velasquez established manifest injustice to withdraw his guilty plea, and he has that higher burden because it came after his sentencing. Refer the court to page 26 of the brief, where he discusses some of the specific facts. Page 27 of the unique facts of Mr. Velasquez's plea. Mr. Velasquez was in court on October 30th, 2014 for a motions hearing, motion in limine and a motion regarding jury instructions. After the court declined to rule on that until the trial, then Mr. Velasquez was presented with a plea agreement, which apparently in the record there was a Spanish interpreter there with him. He had been preparing to go to trial. The trial date was set for December 2nd of 2014. It appears in about a five-minute time period after the court ruled on the motions, Mr. Velasquez's trial counsel discussed with him this written plea agreement with a Spanish translator who was there for the hearing. The plea was signed, entered, and the colloquy was taking place. Mr. Velasquez had but a few minutes to review and sign the plea agreement and virtually no consultation with his trial attorney. There's nothing in the record to suggest that there have been any plea negotiations prior to that hearing on October 30. So what the trial court is saying that it is sufficient for a Spanish-speaking defendant with a translator to be presented a written plea agreement and to have to be discussed in court after a motions hearing for approximately 5 minutes. And I think that under all the circumstances, I think that is, I think Mr. Velasquez established with manifest injustice because there's nothing that would say, I think that the trial counsel would have had an obligation to at least say, thank you for this written plea agreement, it's a very good one, let me take it to my client and have some time, sit down with him and look at the details of this agreement and explain to him the benefits of this agreement as opposed to the risk of trial. There's a lot to be discussed in a five or six page plea agreement, even with someone who speaks English. And I think that under the circumstances that when it was presented, and there's no indication there have been any plea negotiations prior to that to say that Mr. Velasquez had any notice of this plea agreement before that day, I think that it would be manifestly unjust to not allow Mr. Velasquez to withdraw his plea under these circumstances. And I think the record is clear, based upon the motion to withdraw hearing, that he was well aware of the consequences of withdrawing his plea, well aware of the possibility of other charges coming back, and he was adamant about nevertheless wanting to withdraw his guilty plea, and whether it be advisable or not by his trial counsel, he has that right. I would like to reserve the rest of my time. Unless there are any further questions, I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Lauren Campbell, representing the Commonwealth on this appeal. The Commonwealth asserts that both of the trial court's alternative rulings are correct, and this court should affirm the Court of Appeals and the trial court's decision that the first assignment of it on the first assignment of error, or alternatively, affirm the trial court on the second assignment of error. First, the trial court and the Court of Appeals were correct in holding that the trial court lacked jurisdiction to rule on the motion to vacate the defendant's guilty plea after he had filed a notice to the Court of Appeal.
Can I ask you this? Jurisdiction is ordinarily a statutory matter. I mean, there may be some constitutional aspects, too. And 192296 seems to allow a window of 21 days to entertain these motions. So you have a statutory basis for these motions. Why doesn't the statute control?
Because, Your Honor, that statute isn't an ancillary statutory right for the defendant. It goes directly to the jurisdiction of the appellate court in that it would immediately conflict with any jurisdiction that the appellate court had because it wouldn't just be an ancillary statutory provision. It actually goes to the defendant's conviction, which is in front of the appellate court. So if the trial court were to rule on the motion to vacate and it would ultimately then be, and if it granted it, it would ultimately be vacating a conviction in its entirety, which is what is actually up in front of the appellate court. It's not something...
Well, that would moot, perhaps, the appellate proceeding.
Perhaps, Your Honor, but that it's not appropriate at that time because the defendant has already filed a notice of appeal.
But it just seems odd to ask the appellate court, using rules or judicial interpretation, to override what appears to me to be a plain language statutory command.
Certainly, Your Honor, and that the time frame in that statute is 21 days, whereas the notice of appeal wasn't actually due until 30 days. So practically, in the vast majority of cases, they would not conflict. And unfortunately, in this case, the defendant chose to file his notice of appeal and the motion on the same day, and then his motion wasn't heard until a few days later, still within the 21 days. However, that was the defendant's choice.
And if the premature filing of a notice of appeal or an early filing of a notice of appeal doesn't foreclose necessarily trial court jurisdiction, then why don't we just set the window at 30 days out and then that takes care of that problem?
I'm sorry, what window of 30 days out?
Well, you have 30 days from entry
right.
of the final order to file your notice of appeal, and so if the jurisdiction doesn't occur until that 30 days have passed, there actually would be no conflict.
So
proceed with your argument. Don't worry about my question.
Counsel, let me follow up. I believe that the term of art you used was that the matter is before the appellate court, based upon the filing of the notice of appeal. But at that point, what is before the appellate court other than a single piece of paper saying we intend to do something in the future?
Sure, Your Honor. What's before this court is the, physically, obviously, the record hasn't transferred or there's been nothing else filed but the notice of appeal. But the notice of appeal has put the parties on notice that the defendant has appealed the matter to the Court of Appeals, and at that point in time, the Court of Appeals could begin to rule on a number.
What, rule on what? Based upon a bare notice. What could the Court of Appeals rule on?
It could rule on any sort of extension for the petition or in this court.
But we are not presuming that there is a single motion or petition that has yet been filed. All we are presuming is that there is a single sheet of paper. So there is not, I guess what I'm saying is, you would have to agree that there is nothing yet before the Court of Appeals that requires a ruling.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, this appears to have an interesting clerical issue to it, because I'm aware of some of the practices in the Court of Appeals having been there. As a matter of fact, a lot of the people on this bench have been there. The clerk of the Court of Appeals actually signs the number to the case as soon as they get the notice. Now, we don't do that at the Supreme Court. You don't get a number. You're not here, in our judgment, until you have a petition. And I wonder, certainly clerical practices are not going to be considered as a part of the analysis of this case. Would you agree?
I would agree that there is more to it than just the clerical aspect of the Court of Appeals. It's been discussed in the defendant's argument how the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court have very different appellate jurisdictions, and the Court of Appeals actually sees and hears a lot, significant more appeals of right. The Commonwealth's argument would be that is why the Court of Appeals handles its cases differently. It assigns numbers as soon as the notice of appeal come in, because it would not be practical for the Court of Appeals to have jurisdiction only when petitions come in, because in a significant number of its cases, it does not receive petitions. They file a notice of appeal and they immediately go into a briefing schedule. The Commonwealth is aware that that is not what happens in these types of cases, but that is why the Court of Appeals has a different procedure than the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court only dockets cases once petitions are filed, because, to my knowledge, the only appeal of rights to the Supreme Court is, like, the capital case, the Wallen case that I cited in my brief. And this court recognized in that case that the notice of appeal is the triggering jurisdiction requirement.
Isn't that still a workable distinction? I mean, none of this makes intuitive, logical sense, but we have to have a rule of some kind that's clear to everyone. And historically, even back in the Askew case, the Attorney General's office took the position that discretionary appeals, the appeal jurisdiction is vested when the petition is filed. Now, your office has changed that view, I understand, but I'm not sure why. But more importantly, why isn't that a clear rule, and why doesn't that serve the economy of the judiciary, as well as provide guidance to the lawyers? Which would mean, in this case, you would lose, because the Court of Appeals would have jurisdiction.
Certainly, Your Honor. I think that, while that is a workable rule, I do think that it depends on what the matter is. I'm trying to say this correctly. I think it really depends on what exactly the trial court is being asked to do, because there are obviously things that it could continue to do. But in this case, this is very specific.
May I interrupt you for one second? That's a great point, and I think it's sometimes lost in the argument. The fact that the appellate court has jurisdiction doesn't mean that the trial court can do nothing. That's the non sequitur in this debate. There still is, as Justice McCullough pointed out, statutory grounds to go forward. So if a petition for appeal is filed on day two, and the statute allows 21 days to do something else, the proper remedy would be you go to the, and if jurisdiction vested at the moment of the petition for appeal, you go to the appellate court, seek leave for the trial court to rule? And the answer would be, of course. So, I mean, there's concurrent jurisdiction in that handover phase. Otherwise, it would be terribly impossible to manage this. So don't assume, at least in my questions, that concurrent jurisdiction cannot exist, because it clearly does exist.
Yes, Your Honor, and I suppose if this court were to decide that the concurrent jurisdiction exists, the Commonwealth's position would still be that the trial court did not have the jurisdiction or ability to rule on this motion to vacate, and the Court of Appeals and the trial court should still be affirmed, because the motion, as I previously discussed, the motion to vacate would have effectively completely removed this from the Court of Appeals jurisdiction if it was ruled on in the defendant's favor, and for that reason the Commonwealth would assert that the trial court was correct in that finding.
Well, when you say motion to vacate, the motion was to withdraw.
Yes.
But let me move to a motion to vacate. Is your position that once a notice of appeal is filed in a case like this, that the trial court loses jurisdiction to vacate its judgment?
Yes, Your Honor, I think based on my argument in this case, that would be true.
They always give the youngest members of the Attorney General's office the hardest cases.
I appreciate the sentiment, Your Honor.
So what is the reason now? I'm really curious. Why did the Attorney General reverse his position from ask you until now? Because we dealt with this exact question, albeit in dicta, in Justice Clanahan's opinion, and I was on the panel, I think. And what explains going the other way? What's the explanation that would make sense?
Your Honor, I don't think I have an answer to you as to why the office changed its policy or its position, other than that this case to the Commonwealth or to me is different than Askew, and that it is not an ancillary matter, and perhaps I did not set forth the best argument in arguing that it is different more predominantly because of it not being an ancillary matter, and then just no jurisdiction whatsoever. But the Commonwealth still puts forward the position that the trial court would not have appropriately been able to rule on this motion.
Counsel, or could it be that Gamet? Oh.
Counsel, your opposing counsel got a friendly question. Here's a friendly question. If the circuit court did retain jurisdiction, then it did rule, if alternatively it had jurisdiction, that there was no manifest injustice. Why is the circuit court correct?
Your Honor, the circuit court is correct because for a number of reasons, which the circuit court actually outlined factually why the defendant had failed to prove manifest injustice. And this court and the Black's Law Dictionary has sort of explained what manifest injustice is, and it's something that is unmistakable, indisputable, obvious error. And that's simply not the case here. The defendant has not even proffered a reasonable defense, which would actually be under a lower standard even, which he argues on brief because his sentencing and his guilty plea occurred on the same day. The defendant also has argued that there's no evidence in the record that plea negotiations were occurring prior to that motion, but on page 10 of the record, trial counsel actually says that this is all part of a plea negotiation strategy and that the Commonwealth has made an offer. So plea negotiations were going on before entry of the guilty plea and before that motion in limine. After the motion in limine was not successful, the defendant chose to plead guilty, engaged in a lengthy plea colloquy, and the Commonwealth understands that under normal circumstances, the plea colloquy cannot be used against him. However, at the
hearing... And there was a translator and all that.
Yes, there was a translator at all his hearings, which he served, including his preliminary hearing, the motion in limine hearing, his guilty plea and sentencing, and the hearing on this motion, where he also affirmed that he testified truthfully at his guilty plea colloquy, and essentially saying that he did understand, he was mostly just confused and felt rushed. However, the trial court pointed out that it made a particular tactical decision in breaking up questions at the guilty plea hearing to make sure things went slowly and the defendant fully understood. There's nothing in this record that supports the argument that the defendant did not understand what he was doing, all the elements of his offense, and did not have time to review the plea agreement, or that he was ill-advised by his counsel, which is essentially his argument.
One last question. Assuming this court were to rule that the Court of Appeals had jurisdiction, the trial court had jurisdiction, does your office have a position on whether or not we should nonetheless cut to the chase, go to the merits, and address manifest injustice, or whether we should give the Court of Appeals an opportunity to address it in the first instance?
I think the Court of Appeals declined to rule on the issue, and that this court could affirm the trial court's decision based on any reason in the record, and that that would be appropriate for this court to decide.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, in conclusion, the Commonwealth would just request that this court affirm the trial court finding either that it was correct and that it did not have jurisdiction to rule on the motion, or alternatively, that it was correct when it found, nevertheless, the defendant had failed to demonstrate manifest injustice as required by statute.
Thank you. Thank you. Rebuttal, you have 3 minutes and 47 seconds.
Thank you. The Commonwealth says that the deadline, the petition for appeal deadline conferring jurisdiction and divesting a trial court of jurisdiction may be workable. But I would ask the court to consider it's not only workable, it is practical and efficient with respect to everything that needs to be happening in appeal. And that at that time, at the time a petition for appeal is filed, a notice of appeal does not confer jurisdiction in and of itself. There are other prerequisites. The notice has to be timely filed. It has to name the necessary parties. There is a case that name escapes me now. It's a DUI case that didn't name the locality in there, and therefore the notice of appeal was deficient and didn't confer jurisdiction to hear the appeal. You know that a petition for appeal has jurisdictional requirements in addition to the timing that need to be met. By the time that you have a timely filed petition for appeal, the record has been determined. The 1.1, Rule 1.1, 21-day judge finality issue has been determined. You're at a practical deadline where the court can take jurisdiction at that point because everything presumably has been met to confer jurisdiction at that point. So it is more than just a workable event.
If we agree with you.
Yes.
Are we capable of determining the manifest injustice question, or should we send it back to the Court of Appeals?
I think you're capable. I think that you can only rule on what the Court of Appeals, and if the Court of Appeals didn't rule on it and made an error on the jurisdictional issue, I think you might have to send it back to get a decision from them.
I think the rules are different than that. The rules are that we can't rule on anything that wasn't presented to the Court of Appeals. The fact that they didn't rule on it doesn't necessarily mean we can't decide it.
So in light of that, you wouldn't have any objection to, you wouldn't argue against us deciding?
I would not argue against that because I think the issue was developed in the Court of Appeals and was developed in the briefing here. On that issue, of the manifest injustice issue, it just strikes me that the issue of Mr. Velasquez being presented a plea agreement and having approximately 5 to 10 minutes to review it in court with his counsel, with a Spanish interpreter at a motions hearing, under the circumstances, does not rise to the level of appropriate amount of time for him to have considered whether he wanted to go to trial. The record is clear. He was ready to go to trial. Whatever his trial counsel said about plea strategy with respect to the motion that he filed on jury instruction, the motion to eliminate, the trial court was set. Mr. Velasquez was ready to go to trial. He was in court that day on a motions hearing, not anticipating, at least in the record, any plea offers to be presented to him that day. I think even if he were English-speaking, I think it is improvident for trial counsel to argue a motion, lose that motion, and then sit down and present a written plea agreement that needs to be considered and decided upon at that time. And when his notice of appeal that he filed pro se on November 10th, before the final written sentencing order was even finished, indicates that he was rushed into this. And I think the issue of translators and everything is a red herring. I think any defendant in that circumstance should be afforded more time to make those type of decisions. And he may well have been, it appears from the record, rushed into something he didn't want to do. So unless there are any questions, I think my time is about up.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for listening to me.
Call the